Patriotic Berto Willis, who has his own show Monday nights, Politics Done Right, Mondays 9 p.m. here on this very same channel. It's 10:01 p.m. So much to talk about. It's open forum tonight, so I'm going to throw out some things that have sort of come to my attention and interested me for one reason or another, but you can take the conversation in any direction you want. The phone number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. And I'm sure you'll understand if I say we still have some open lines. Okay, I'm going to do my voting nag in a minute, but first there's something I want to mention. Apparently, there is a, I'm going to use the term cat serial killer in the Heights. I don't mean this to sound flip. There is a person in the Heights who is torturing, killing, and dismembering people's cats, and then leaving them in front of the houses where the cats lived. This is actually, I mean, aside from the fact that it's sad for the cats, and aside from the fact that it's sad for the people who loved the cats. It's worth noting that these kinds of people eventually go on to become serial killers. Generally speaking, cat killers, animal people who torture animals, kill animals, these people very, very often, I'm not going to say 100% of the time, but very often, these are the people that essentially are practicing to become murderers. So whatever your feeling is about cats, I've, in my old age, turned into something of a cat person. I love dogs. I like animals generally. I've become attached to cats recently in my life. They're a perfect lazy person's pet. So because now I kind of have affection for a specific cat, this hurts me more than it might have a little while ago. But, you know, the bigger issue is, what do you do with people like this? Let's assume he's caught, he or she. There is a Heights area pet owner offering a $10,000 reward on Craigslist. I have the link to that on tonight's blog post for the show, thinkwingradio.com, among other things on there. It's an interesting reward offer, $10,000 for the person responsible for killing these cats. And if this person is caught, it might save some people's lives. Just wanted to mention that. Now I'm going to go into my election year nag. We are coming to elections. Make sure you're registered. Make sure you have the proper ID. Make sure you vote. If your vote didn't matter, they wouldn't be trying so hard to suppress it. Make sure you vote. You can go, if you live in Harris County, you can go to harrisvotes.com. If you live outside of Harris County, you can get information from the Texas Secretary of State at votetexas.gov. votetexas.gov, harrisvotes.com. That's all one word, by the way, Harris Votes. Next election is November 4th. Early voting starts October 20th and runs through October 31st. I strongly encourage people to early vote. It is so much easier. The lines are generally shorter. They generally move faster. You can go to any early voting place that is convenient for you before or after work. You don't have to find your specific precinct, your specific ballot location. I'm telling you, early voting is absolutely the way to go. Make sure you go out and vote. Make sure people you know go out and vote. Turnout, turnout, turnout. Okay, next thing. The Secret Service has been in the news a little lately. And by the way, we have open lines, 713-526-5738. Secret Service has been having its problems. Whoring, drunkenness, possibly dereliction, at the very least, perhaps inadequate training, insufficient alertness, maybe understaffing, underfunding, a lot of different issues at play, perhaps inadequately led. Very, very complicated. There is one thing, though, I wanted to mention. You've had some critics saying, you know, the Secret Service used to be so fantastic, and over the last 20 years or so, it's just degraded, and morale has sunk, et cetera, et cetera. And the reason that strikes me as at least a little ironic, not that I'm an expert in the Secret Service, but the reason that strikes me as a little ironic, there is a 1992 book which caught some public traction within the last year or two called Mortal Error, The Shot That Killed JFK. It's a nonfiction book by Bonner Menninger based on a theory by Howard Donahue, who is a sharpshooter, gunsmith, and ballistics expert. And to make a long story short, the book posits that based on the ballistics evidence, the testimonial evidence, the forensic evidence, it's the only thing I've ever heard where everything seems to fit just beautifully together. The fatal shot that killed John Kennedy was an accident of friendly fire. I mean, this is really interesting and creepy and sad, but Lee Harvey Oswald fired the first shot that hit the president, back of the neck exiting the bottom of the throat. But the fatal headshot may in fact have been accidentally fired by a Secret Service agent using a new and perhaps slightly unfamiliar weapon, the AR-15, which in 1963 was a brand new weapon. The Secret Service car, as the presidential limousine accelerated, the Secret Service car accelerated behind it. His weapon may have had the safety off, which would have made sense if he thought he was going to be firing at a shooter. The car accelerated, he dropped backward, weapon accidentally discharged, firing a shot which ballistically is highly feasible as the fatal headshot that killed Kennedy. It's, I mean, I remember, I was 10 years old, 12 years old when Kennedy was shot. I remember that. I've lived through all of the conspiracy theories. I've lived through the Warren Commission. I've lived through all of the speculations about this, that, and the other, and the guy on the grassy knoll. This is the only theory I've ever heard that after the documentary was done and they'd gone through all the evidence, I went, yep, that's the first thing I've heard in 50 years that makes sense. So, the Secret Service has done a really great job, except for that one time when they might have killed the president. These things happen. Human error. Human error. It's the thing you can never get out of the loop. Open lines. 713-526-5738, if there's anything you would like to bring up or discuss that I'm bringing up. Syria. Syria and Iraq and ISIS, still in the news. Still in the news. There has been a debate that has kind of broken out, a public argument, if you will. President Obama, in an interview with 60 Minutes, made the comment that the intelligence community underestimated ISIS. which of course got a lot of people in the intelligence community really bent out of shape, saying, no, 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 we sent in reports where we said that ISIS was the threat that it has become, that they were motivated, they were prepared, they were armed. We told you so. And this is one of those situations where it's entirely possible that both sides are telling the absolute truth. Here's my theory. I haven't heard this anywhere else, so you can call and tell me if you think I'm wrong. That's fine. But here's the thing. We have a lot of different intelligence agencies in this government. You've got naval intelligence, army intelligence, general military intelligence, is probably marine intelligence, Coast Guard intelligence. You've got the NSA. There are lots of different departments and agencies that collect their own intelligence. And then there's this thing called the CIA. And we don't really think about what the CIA does because all we ever call it is the CIA. The CIA is the central intelligence agency. What that means is when they created the CIA, the idea was that all of these different intelligence agencies, in addition to whatever use they might specifically make of the intelligence they collect, all of this intelligence would feed into the central intelligence agency, which is why it's called central. It would then be evaluated, a little bit like a civil case. You would look at a preponderance of the evidence. What is the source? Where is the source? What do they have to gain? How good is their information? What might be their motivations? All of these different things, including are they telling the truth? Are they telling the truth as they know it? Are they double agents? You know, all these different things. So the Central Intelligence Agency weighs all these things, digests it, and at some point they have a report that they present to the president. It is completely possible that there were intelligence guys who completely, totally foresaw what ISIS was going to be doing. But it's also entirely possible that by the time this intelligence digest, this triage of intelligence, got to President Obama, and this is speculation on my part, but it's entirely possible that what he got was more ambiguous, a little less decisive, because they were taking all of these elements. So the people that say, we notified the intelligence service, we wrote up reports, they're probably telling the truth. I don't necessarily doubt them. When the president says, well, the intelligence we got wasn't conclusive, that's also possible because of the way it was interpreted and digested and presented. It's just one of those freaky things. We have open lines, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. We have a caller on the line, John. Thank you for calling and giving me someone to talk to, because the sound of my own voice occasionally even annoys me.
It doesn't bug me at all, my friend.
I appreciate that. So,
that's why I'm always listening.
Thank you.
What I was called about, because I was driving, I missed the title of the book that you were referring to.
Oh, yeah. It's called Mortal Error.
Mortal Error.
Mortal
okay.
Error, the shot that killed JFK. The last okay. name of the author is Menninger.
Okay. It sounds like a good read. All of the other conspiracy theories, you know, 300-400 people involved. But I do have one question. It just made me think of something.
Okay.
If this actually is true, wouldn't we still have quite a few people involved in covering it up? It might not have been a conspiracy for the assassination, but
the
it certainly would have to be for the cover-up.
Well, I mean, if you look at the timeline, anybody who had any knowledge or participation in that event now would probably conservatively be in their middle 70s, if not their 80s or 90s.
Right, yes.
So... But you know, there may be some evidence, there may be some family stories, there may be some deathbed confessions. Or it may be that, you know, these are the kinds of things like combat soldiers, they just put it out of their minds, and by pretending it didn't happen, it effectively didn't happen.
Well, yeah, I imagine if it actually is the case that the poor Secret Service guy that made the error, you know, you have post-traumatic, the syndrome from being in war.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine if that is the case, what that poor guy went through.
It had to have been, I mean, whatever the cover-up, even if you were never brought to terms in the press or in court, It had to be the most horrible thing to live with.
Yes.
Maybe almost worse, because in all likelihood, he would not have gone to jail. He would have been maybe kicked out of the service. He would have been ashamed. He would have been humiliated for the rest of his life. But in all likelihood, you know, it was an accidental shooting. It was friendly fire in the heat of combat, in a sense.
Yeah, so that it, more than that we know, probably it happens, and it's just. But I had seen something about that a while ago. Maybe it was referring to the book where they came up with that theory. But to tell you something that's just sort of, I don't know, I guess I could say ironic, was when all of this started to break, I just happened to be, I watched the History Channel, actually, you know, all of those kind of things. And one of them had about the security at the White House.
You know,
it's just about impenetrable.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where one of the discussions they had, maybe they've had it on several shows, is what's more important in terms of the reporting? Is it more important that this stuff be aired in public so that the American public knows what's going on? Or, as a national security matter, is it more important to maintain the mythology of the strength of the Secret Service? Or are we otherwise inviting people to say, oh, maybe this is more feasible than we thought. Maybe if we really do have people coming at a half a dozen points, we can do a Benghazi right here in Washington, D.C.
Yes, yes.
So, that, tough call.
And with the Secret Service, I don't like using the term lackadaisical, but listening to Rachel a few days ago, she's been on it quite a bit.
Yes.
She was saying about how these guys, that's their full-time job, is to wander around.
Yeah.
And to stay on alert for that, you know, they're paramilitary guys, I guess you can call them.
It's tough to be at peak alert indefinitely.
Pardon?
It's tough to be at peak alert indefinitely. It's virtually impossible.
I would think so. I would think so. But as I was telling the young man that answered the phone, I was out for a few weeks and haven't been able to call you, and I'm glad to hear you again.
Well, I appreciate it very, very much. I appreciate your calling and appreciate your listening.
Every chance I get, my friend.
Thank you so
much. You have a great night, sir.
You too. You take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and my companion Egberto Willis, who is just flattered by being called a young man. He's so pleased. That's like well into my 40s. I said, are you sure you don't want to card me? Yeah, it's just a thing, you know, getting old. It really bites. We have open lines, 713. By the way, 90.1 FM Houston, KPFT. I needed to finish my station ID. I got distracted because I'm kind of an adult ADD kind of guy. We have open lines, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Okay, other interesting stuff that came to my attention. We have, of course, we, the United States and our allies, great and small, have been conducting this air war now against ISIS and other jihadists. I'm not going to necessarily say al-Qaeda because that's not inclusive enough, other jihadist forces in Iraq and Syria. And there has been a lot of debate about this boots-on-the-ground thing. Just as an aside, boots-on-the-ground is a term that came up during the Clinton administration in relation to Kosovo. Just saying. It's one of those catchphrases that just people loved and it caught on. If someone asks, I'll be happy to explain that further. So you have, I mean, weirdly, it's always so weird to me. You know, Lindsey Graham, he's not a veteran. I can understand him being what is insultingly called a chicken hawk. I guess sometimes I'm a chicken hawk. Was Lindsey Graham in the military?
Yeah, he's a JAG officer.
Is that quite the same thing?
Well, yeah, he had
I
to
mean,
go
he
through.
Was in, I'm doing air quotes, he was I, in the military.
Yeah.
But.
He served.
Combat?
I don't think it's combat, but he served.
Combat training?
Yeah, I think he had to.
Guard duty?
I mean, he's a JAG officer.
Okay, so sort of military.
I don't want to take anything away from the guy. I think he's wrong, but I mean, I don't want to take anything away from him. He served.
Here's what I'm going to say. This is not necessarily politically correct, but I think it's fair. Not everybody who serves is a hero. if everybody who serves is a hero, the term hero itself becomes devalued. There are genuine heroes. I'm not saying that the people that serve are not brave, and I'm not saying the people that serve are not doing an incredible service for the country, but not everybody is a hero.
I don't want us to call everybody a hero, but I am going to tell you, I have a tremendous amount of respect for anybody who signed that piece of paper and become a general issue.
You have to. You absolutely have to.
I didn't.
And I didn't either. Although I was exposed to the draft for a year, so that's my Hail Mary. But, yeah, on the other hand, though, Lindsey Graham was never in combat. We're not sure he ever had a bullet fired at him. He was a JAG. That's, what does JAG stand for again?
He's actually an attorney.
I know he's an attorney. What does JAG stand for?
I don't
for?
Remember what it stands for. I'll look it up for you.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I know there was a show on JAG, but I never watched it, so, and I know what it is. I just can't come up with it. It's like old person syndrome. But people like John McCain puzzle the heck out of me. Here's a guy, Navy pilot, combat, shot down, captured, prisoner of war for years, tortured by the North Vietnamese. You would think if anybody, yes.
Judge Advocate.
Thank you so much. Judge Advocate General. Yeah. Okay. JAG. We know these are frontline guys. They're the first wave onto the beach so that they can sue the enemy. Just saying. I'm not getting a reaction out of Egberto. That's why I'm you can't see this because this is radio, but I'm just, he gave me a little. Okay. But how can someone like John McCain, who has been through such horror and survived it, and this is the guy that keeps saying, boots on the ground, boots on the ground, boots on the ground, bomb them, invade them, go to war with them, attack them.
It's not him.
But it was him.
But it will never, ever be him again.
But doesn't empathy come in here anywhere?
No. Listen, there is a group of folk that, I mean, I hate, if you look at the conservative mind, there's a scientific reality about those who are genuinely have a conservative mind. I'm not talking about quasi-conservatives.
There have been
or
a lot of psychological studies of conservatives v. liberals.
Right, and these guys really do not have empathy.
In many cases, I think that's true. And they have to have a trauma in order to develop any empathy. But McCain has had the trauma.
And that's how it proves that he's a real conservative. He is a real conservative.
He's fought through the empathy to his conservative values.
Think about it. Think about all the Republicans who've come out who now understand gay marriage equality.
Gay relationships.
Right. Most of them come to that realization after a son
or a
daughter has had it. Look at Cheney. Look at all these guys. Only when
Darth Cheney becoming the empathy guy.
Only when it directly affects somebody that they love or they themselves does it really matter. That's the only time it matters.
You know that evil was once defined unofficially as the lack of empathy. This was during the Nuremberg trials. Yeah, I actually have the quote somewhere. It's one of those quotes that occasionally when I do email, I tag at the bottom. And there was an army psychologist, a captain, who was tasked with evaluating the Nazi prisoners, the high officials like Goering and Hess and these others. And there is a somewhat lengthy quote. This is one of those books. I'm not a nonfiction book guy, but this is a book I think I want to read. There was a lengthy quote where he says, after studying these people and trying to understand them and kind of get in their heads, and I'm obviously paraphrasing extremely, he said, I have come to the conclusion that if there is a definition of evil, it is a lack of empathy. Now, that is not a clinical conclusion to the extent of having done various tests and scientifically determinable results and statistical bases and that kind of thing, but it has become sort of a truism, I think, And I think that there's some validity to it. We have open lines, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Anyhow, so getting back to the topic of Syria and boots on the ground and ISIS and that, you listen to all of these different sides. You've got the so-called Free Syrian Army and their allies, the sort of pro-Westernish Syrian rebels. And apparently they get really annoyed at us because we're bombing al-Nusra, which apparently is one of their strongest allies in the fight against Assad, because Assad is their goal, overthrowing Assad. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of what's going on in Syria now probably would not have gone the way it went if Assad had resigned or been overthrown much earlier. Things just evolve. But now here's where it gets interesting. The Free Syrian Army, and I've had someone from the Syrian American Council on here, they're very upset that the United States has made the mission degrading and destroying ISIS rather than overthrowing Assad. Now, the United States has taken the position, well, that's not our mandate. We have an enemy. Our enemy is ISIS. We are fighting a war against ISIS. And I think what this is kind of coming down to, it's a really clear example of the fact that the United States, in my opinion, we're essentially fighting our own war. We have an enemy, or several enemies, al-Nusra being one, because they are an avowed al-Qaeda affiliate.
What war are we fighting? Could you tell me what
that is? All
right,
we can get to that question, but we are essentially fighting a war against this group and these groups that are allied with them or like them that consider essentially the entire Western world their enemy. You can argue that's a different discussion. Should we? Shouldn't we? What should we? If we should? All of those questions. But we have different goals. Our goal, if Assad was overthrown, that would be a happy accident, but it's not our goal. That's the goal of the Free Syrian Army. So to the extent that our interests overlap, that's great, but should our goal be their goal? Now, here's where it starts to get a little bit more interesting. Before I came in to do the show, I always try to do, especially if I don't have a guest, and I know it's going to be open forum, I did a quick scan of the news to see if there was anything recent that if I didn't know, I'd be embarrassed about. So there is a story from Reuters. Turkey vows to fight Islamic State coalition strikes near border. Apparently, because ISIS is getting close to the Syrian border, and now they have the Turks have tanks lined up along their border just kind of in case, and I guess as a combination of NATO lobbying, American lobbying, perhaps British lobbying, maybe Saudi lobbying, who knows what lobbying, plus their own perceived threat perhaps from ISIS, because ISIS isn't going to be friends with them either. Plus, they've got their own Kurdish situation. It's all very complicated. The whole Middle East is just always very complicated, which is why you don't necessarily want to be picking sides in our case. But here's the thing. President, and I'm going to mispronounce it, Tayyip Erdogan said the removal of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad remained a Turkish priority, and stressed Ankara's fears that U.S.-led strikes without a broader political strategy would prolong the instability. And to go on a little further down the article, and I have a link to the article on tonight's show post, the Turks did say that they might very well put boots on the ground. So the way this kind of evolves, it's one of those situations I've talked about before. History, as written, looks like it's cast in stone. But just like the number of points on the head of a pin, the possibilities are infinite. So just because one strategy didn't work, that means the alternative strategy would have worked any better. It might have turned out worse. We just don't know. In the wisdom of hindsight, it may turn out, one can hope, Obama was a genius. Everything worked out for the best. We provided air support and logistical support, and the countries in the region were the ones that went in and did, pardon the expression, the dirty work. And of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that everything will turn out fine. Everything may simply turn out. I mean, I don't know that anything in the Middle East ever turns out fine. Anyway, we have a caller on the line. I'll do a quick ID and then we'll get to him. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and my compatriot Egberto Willis. It is just about 10:30, KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Gary, you're on the air. How are you doing tonight? Thanks for calling.
Hello. I'm completely confused.
I've done my job.
You're mixing your metaphors, or you have been hoisted by your own petard because you're talking about John McCain having experienced combat, and then you went into your little talk about the meaning of evil and being heartless and having no empathy.
ADD is a tough thing to have.
What he wants to do is initiate a fight against Islamic State after they've been crucifying and beheading and killing and starving and murdering people that are even not only the other religions in the area, but even other Muslims. So, you know, could you clarify your point? Are you pro or con the necessity to fight this, quote, evil?
That is a great question. I love that question because, as it probably sounds to you, I am torn. I would like to think that our country does good. Of course, our country doesn't always do good. No country always does good. I hope we do good on balance. I would like to think that as a great power, as a humanistic power, we feel an obligation to help right wrongs, to help protect the weak. You know, basically Superman with a big military. On the other hand, you know, it's war. You can't police the world effectively, even if you want to, even if your objective is to do good. Your objective of doing good may not be other people's ideas of doing good. We've learned that. I've lived...
Well, now wait.
Okay.
What exactly is the difference between an individual killing innocent cats in the Heights...
Okay.
...and people that
you
are
have
murdering
been listening.
Entire villages full of human beings in the Middle East? You don't think that we, you know, we got criticized because we did nothing about the Rwandan genocide.
And I've done that.
And
yeah.
We've been criticized because we haven't intervened in other places.
Yes.
But now, if there was ever a case necessitating intervention, the Islamic State is it, because they have stated their objectives and they have proven their objectives. They've killed thousands of people.
I basically agree with you, Gary.
And
that's why I'm torn.
Who's going to do it? Saudi Arabia? Come on. We sell them their airplanes.
But at the end of the day, while it could be us, should it be us? Does it need to be us? That's
right.
Why if now I know you were listening because you've been saying back a lot of the stuff I said, to my chagrin perhaps.
Well, you got me confused because you seem to be compassionate and then you seem to be unwilling to be compassionate if it doesn't suit your political purposes. All that talk about conservatives and liberals, it doesn't matter what stripe you wear. If you want to prevent someone from cutting some innocent person's head off just because they're not like you.
But we can't do everything everywhere.
Who else will?
That's a great question.
Well, that's the point.
But here's the thing. If we can put together an alliance, and I think that's what Obama is doing, and perhaps with some more success than people gave him credit for at the outset, if we do what we do well, which is reconnaissance, surveillance, air power, logistical support, and we do those things, and the people in the region take care of their business with our help, that's the ideal.
I think that, you know, the old saying, if you break it, you own it.
Yeah, we definitely
right now,
broke.
Syria is a basket case, and they're taking advantage of the power vacuum there,
yes.
IS is. And Iraq is a disaster,
yes.
And I think we kind of necessitated that. Now, here's the great irony, and I'll hang up and listen. You know,
I don't know. You're doing pretty good interrogating me.
Well, we are a democratic nation, and we believe in popular vote, as you also noted earlier, and these things. And, of course, we went in and we're toppling all these strongmen. But we don't have a clue about the cultural realities of these countries. It's not like, you know, Mayberry RFD over there. There are hundreds of tribes and animosities that go back 1,000 years before the United States even existed. And, you know, we were Saddam Hussein was our best friend as far as stability in the Middle East. And we went and offed them. And the consequence is total chaos and disaster. And then I also want to note that the United Arab Emirates and the Saudi Arabian Air Force also assisted us before the French or the British got involved. So they are doing their part, but you just have to draw a line between acceptable human behavior, you know, and the realities of geopolitics, because this is not about oil, and it's not about Republicans being bloodthirsty. It's about a reality that's killing human beings, just like that guy's killing cats. And somebody has to stand up, and if not us, there is no other. Look at Russia. They're Assad's ally. They're the anti-Ukrainian. You know, they don't care about the dissolving of you. What about China? China, I don't think they could care less. As you can see in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. So I think that the United States is just like being the biggest kid in the schoolyard and some other kid is beating someone up because they're a bully and you don't have the courage to go stop him from bullying the other kid. You have no choice. If you're a moral person, you have to stand up for what's right, even if it's somewhat damaging or compromising to you. All right? You know, a lot of people been killed. Like that, remember that veteran? And he was here in Houston, and he tried to intervene in a store robbery in a convenience store, and he got shot and killed.
Yeah, all right?
Well, he died. That was dumb. Man, what, you got yourself killed? You come back from Iraq, and you get killed in a 7-Eleven? The truth is, he did the right thing, and sometimes you have to do that, and sometimes blood is shed. And that's all I have to say.
Okay.
Good night.
Thank you, Gary. I kind of wish Gary had hung on. I think he wanted to go and listen, and now that he had me on the spot, I think he was pleased with himself. I mean, Gary made some great points, and he's right.
I don't think so.
Well, and I'll give you a shot in a moment. He made some great points, and he caught the fact that I am very conflicted. I feel that there's right and there's wrong, and then I also feel there's practical and there's possible and there's pragmatic. So those things make decisions really complicated, which is why, as Harry Truman once said, the buck stops where it stops. I think one thing, and then I'm going to let Egberto express his thoughts on this, but I think it's important to remember always, we do not have a military draft. It's really, really easy, because I've heard this excuse, I'm going to call it an excuse, uttered many times in many places under many circumstances. These people are volunteers. They've volunteered to protect our country, to go where they're ordered to go, and to fight where they're ordered to fight. And they're volunteers. And that's the word that keeps coming up. They're volunteers. When we had a draft, and I'm not saying I like the draft, I didn't want to be drafted. I was a coward, basically. I didn't want to go into the Army. I didn't think I'd be a happy camper there. But when there was a draft and more people literally had skin in the game, this country was a lot more guarded about how they committed their troops. And when this country went to an all-volunteer military, it's not an accident that we've fought more military engagements since then. Instead of keeping the National Guard as a National Guard, we've used them as a second reserve. Because by using regular military and reserve military and National Guard military, they don't have to institute a draft. And that keeps the skin investment of the country small. So George Bush was able to tell people after 9/11, if you're going to be patriotic, go out and shop. That was George Bush's idea of patriotism. Support the economy, go out and shop. 1% of American families have skin in the game. So on the one hand, I want to be proud of this country and feel we do right and do good and protect the weak. On the other hand, blood, money, death, that's the reality. Does it all have to be on us? And it's not even historically or economically smart to put it all on us. War's expensive. It degrades countries. It degrades empires. It degrades nations. The long-term good of this country, in my opinion, is not to constantly invest in war. It weakens us in the long term, which makes us able to do less good, if that's your goal for the country. All right, I'm rambling. Egberto, your thoughts?
On the last comment you made, so true, right? I mean, China isn't doing it, and if anybody who's gone to Shanghai and see the comparison between what infrastructure spending versus military-industrial complex type military-industrial type spending, would see where our infrastructure could be if we decide to give up on our military-industrial complex for fictitious wars. Let me give some examples right here. We talk about being concerned about the beheadings of the few people that we saw. I think it is evil what these guys are doing. It is terrible. It's horrendous.
I think they're the most clearly evil group since the Nazis.
Yeah, I mean, but I'm saying what they're doing is terrible. But likewise, Detroit, Chicago, every night we have men that are shot down, and we don't see our country investing any resources in protecting our own in these different cities. But a few people that are being the people that are being killed overseas in these areas, we should show some concern. The fallacy, I wrote an article for Daily Coast called Conned into War. And the reason I say conned into war, think about it. When the ISIS supposedly took over the Mosul Dam, which they did,
yeah.
These great fighters that could go through these cities undeterred were somehow removed from the dam in 2 days. We have to realize that the reason they're taking over cities is not that they're good, is that they're taking over cities with Sunni sympathists. In other words, people that are sympathizing with them, they have no concern in fighting them, and just the small opposition, no, that's what they get. Are you going to tell me that anybody who decides to cut somebody's heads off, put it on YouTube, put it on social media and say, we are creating a caliphate, we want to take over the world. They can say they want to take over the world as much as they want. They can't. They don't have a military. They don't have a navy. They don't have an air force. It is belittling to the minds of U.S. citizens to believe a bunch of people with some arms on the back of a pickup truck would ever possibly be a concern of the United States of America. We sell arms to both sides, or military-industrial complex. You know, the arms, I wrote another article 2 days, 3 days ago, where I made this fact. These guys are using a lot of American weapons that they stole from the Iraqis. Guess what happens to those? Guess what those weapons need? They need resupply. They need munitions. Where are those munitions coming from? They're coming from the United States or the manufacturers of these weapons. Why don't we stifle that? We say they have $2 billion from banks that they've took over in Mosul and other places. We're in an electronic society. Why not stifle? It doesn't matter that they have $2 billion. If they can't spend the $2 billion, it doesn't matter. We talk about them taking over two refineries and selling oil to make $7 million a day. Well, we are the greatest country in the world. Prevent them from selling the oil. Then they die on their own attrition. We don't have to put our people over there.
But you are buying into the premise of American omnipotence, that we can just make things happen,
It's not American omnipotence.
There are other actors in this. First of all, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Emirates, other countries in that area have American weapons. If they sympathize with ISIS, they can provide them with parts.
Sure.
Is it legal? No.
But let them
Does
do it.
Does it violate the American terms of the sale? Yes.
But
what can we do? The table, illegal,
we have
black market.
Remember, ISIS is not the friend. Supposedly, assuming we're following the tenet of ISIS, which they say we're following. They're saying ISIS wants to create a caliphate in the entire region, then effectively the world. But let's say it's the region only. The region includes the United Emirates. It includes Saudi Arabia.
They can't be happy about that.
Right. So therefore, I mean, if they decide that it's in their interest to support that, then, you know, what are we fighting?
But what if it's not in their interests, but there are people further down the food chain in those countries that have access to various funds and parts and weapons and resupply capabilities, and they are aiding? But let me say this. I think there's an important thing from the American perspective. I believe that countries like people suffer through transformative traumas. I've commented a few times in the past that the Civil War for the United States, in terms of just military doctrine, was a transformative event. We no longer threw men at bullets to absorb the bullets. We no longer attacked in waves. The death toll during the Civil War was so horrendous that it changed the entire U.S. military doctrine, making us unusual in the world as far as war doctrine goes. So that was a transformative, traumatic event. The First and Second World Wars, collectively, were transformative events in terms of lack of preparedness. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, all of our battleships destroyed, much of our military degraded, the Philippines quickly taken. At the outset of the Second World War, we didn't have enough uniforms, we didn't have enough helmets, we didn't have enough guns, we had soldiers training with wooden weapons. It took like a year before we had anything like a coherent military rebuilt, because we were underprepared. So the traumatic lesson, the transformative lesson of the Second World War was be prepared. And coming out of the Second World War, well, we've been nothing if not prepared. Largest military in the world, currently by multiples of our potential competition and allies. Then we had the Korean War, which sort of taught us our limits. We had just come out of this great victory against the European Axis, and we got a little humbled. We didn't lose, but we didn't win. That was the first war that we were considered not to have won in our history. We didn't lose it, but we didn't win. Then Vietnam. Went into Vietnam, 500,000 men, 550,000, something like, I think, at the peak of the war. That was a war we clearly lost. And then we had the Vietnam syndrome that followed us for a generation. These things tend to be generational. It's like you have a generation age and die, and a generation grow up and ignorant, and they have to make the same mistakes over and over again. So we had the Vietnam War, which made us very, very literally and figuratively gun-shy about getting involved in military enterprises overseas. Then you had the Iraq War, which reminded us about the Vietnam syndrome, that you can go in, even if you think you have good intentions, we're not going to talk about the lies and that stuff, but even if you think you have good intentions, that things can go badly awry. So we've had some mixed experiences. Gary thinks I sound conflicted. I think our country is very conflicted because we've had some of these traumatic events, the Civil War changing doctrine, the Pearl Harbor attack, reminding us it's important to be prepared. You can't just let a military totally go back to seed while things are peaceful. Vietnam reminding us we're not undefeatable. Iraq reminding us that we can get sucked into another Vietnam, the limits of our power. And I think all of these things begin to have an effect. It almost makes you freeze in indecision at some point, because you've got now conflicting lessons that have been passed down generationally through family memory, through history books. And I think there are a lot of people like me that, as Gary pointed out, they sound conflicted. They want to do this. They think we should do that. We're not sure what our country should be doing, what we should be standing for, what we should be responsible for. And I think that that's kind of where we stand now. We have, in a sense, I think we have lost our way, not necessarily morally as a nation, but I think we've lost our way geopolitically. We no longer are confident of what works, which makes us much less decisive, or more indecisive, if you want to put it that way, about what we should be doing and what's a good idea and what we should stay out of. Rwanda, it was horrible we did nothing. That we, meaning the rest of the world. Cambodia, it's horrible we did nothing. There are other areas of the world where there have been genocides and slaughters and terrible events. No one person, no one country can do everything. So I don't know what the answer is at the end of the day. I really don't. And that's, I mean, to some extent, that's why I call the show Think Wing, because you got to think about, yes, we can do this, but what happens if we do? And what happens if we don't? A decision to act is a decision. A decision not to act is a decision. And no decision at all is essentially the same as a decision not to act. So no matter what you do, you're making a decision either actively or passively. And you're not always sure what the choice should be. I don't know. Puzzling to me. Quick station ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. We still have about 6 or 7 minutes on the air if you want to call in and put in your 2 cents and tell me I'm right, wrong, or somewhere in between, or like Gary, both. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Egberto, you were nodding your head and shaking your head and obviously thinking.
Well, let me, one of the premises of the arguments that I make is that in America, the most prevalent thing that's done is for us to learn how to think from above. In other words, other people tell us how we should think, and then that is what's occurred. That's why you see that Obama is in Syria and Iraq right now, because popular opinion says that Americans want to attack ISIS, ISIL now. So that's the reason why he's...
There are schools of thought that he can slash should.
Right, but what I'm saying, that he's in there. And how did they get to that position? They got to that position because our media complex made ISIS an existential threat. They made ISIS an existential threat in the psyche of the average American citizen.
Going back to the Second World War and the trauma of the Second World War, you had the appeasers. And I've talked about the fact that we may judge them too harshly based on what we have seen in history since. Democracies, for political and other reasons, don't like war. For the most part, they don't like war. It makes them politically unpopular. Initially popular, and then politically unpopular. Avoiding war from an economic standpoint and a political standpoint is very important. So you had the fascists, and more specifically the Nazis, a disarmed, impoverished, devastated nation, little by little increasing its strength, let them get away with this, let them get away with that, remilitarizing the Ruhr, taking the Sudetenland, annexing Austria. And, I mean, this went on over a period of about 6 years, so it's like slow motion. And then people look back, and when you know the history, and hindsight is 20/20, you go, we should have stopped them. Why didn't we stop them when they were weak? Why didn't we stop them in the Ruhr? After the war, we found documents that Hitler had given orders, if there was any resistance from the French or the British, to withdraw. And that might have been the end of it. We didn't do that. So you look at ISIS, part of what you try to draw from the historical experience is get them while they're small, get them while they're weak. Don't wait until they've taken over Iraq and they've taken over Saudi Arabia and they have the stranglehold of oil, which it's still somewhat about. Why wait until they're big and powerful? At least get them while they're still relatively small and weak. Kill them in the cradle, as it were. What's the right answer? Oh, this is a tough call. I don't know what the right answer is.
I hate to say I do know what the right answer is, and that is that we should not be the ones leading this coalition. The United Nations, if they think that is a particular problem, do it. The America needs to worry about rebuilding America.
Let's say it's 2024.
We either build bombs or we build highways and we educate our own.
I agree. But let's say it's 2024, and looking backward, the correct thing to do is to stop ISIS now.
Look, you know what is the greatest thing about America? And I tell people this all the time. We were blessed with geography. We were blessed to have two big oceans and two friendly countries that make up our borders. We have the ability to sit things out. We really do. And not only that, not only do we have that of geography, but of natural resources. The reality is it's time for others to step up and for us to rebuild. Other countries are allowing us to go to war as they rebuild their infrastructure. And Americans don't know that. When Americans go to Shanghai, they're shocked. When they go to Perth, they're shocked.
Well, wait a minute.
When they go to Brazil, they're shocked.
I've been to Shanghai.
Not recently. Not recently.
Within the last 5 years or so. I've been to Shanghai, I've been on the high-speed rail, I've been to Beijing, I've been to northeastern China a couple of times, and I will tell you, on the one hand, yes, you're right, but I will also tell you, on the other hand, that the infrastructure they're building is very low quality, does not have a long shelf life.
I'm telling you,
that's a different issue on which we agree, but on the one hand, they're investing all of this money in infrastructure, but I will tell you that in large part, the quality of the infrastructure is very poor.
You know, the quality of their infrastructure is poor, but they're doing the right thing.
They're doing the right thing in the wrong way.
Well,
we're doing the wrong thing in the wrong way. So that makes them a little righter than us. It's horrible. All right, if anybody wants to take 2 minutes of phone call, that's about what you got, 713-526-5738. I will tell you a couple of interesting stories about my visit to China. This was over in Acheng, which is a suburb of Harbin, which is where my wife's family was living. And two stories. One, we were walking around, and I saw what looked to me like a really old building. If you go down to Galveston and you look at some of these red brick antebellum pre-Civil War buildings that have like this really aged red look, that's what this building looked like. It looked to me like it was built in the 1850s, 1860s. My wife told me, no, it's 20 years old. So that was one of my first lessons in Chinese infrastructure. Build it fast, build it cheap. And then, not only cheap, but then you've also got the graft that makes it even worse than the original plan was. The other thing that was informative for me, they were building a whole new complex, basically putting in the infrastructure for what essentially would be like a giant mall shopping area. They had paved the roads that were going to be feeding this thing, the various drive paths and stuff. And what I noticed was they were all cracking. There was no traffic. It was still being built. And they were all cracking. They all looked like they'd already gone through five or six winters. I'm going to get to the call that's coming in quickly because I know we don't have much time. There was a guy, this was around dusk, and there was a Chinese gentleman who was putting like a stucco skim coat on all of these cracks to hide them for when the officials came to inspect them so they'd be pretty. So that's Chinese infrastructure building. Okay, we've got a phone call. I don't have a name. Tell me who you are, and you're on the air, and thank you for calling.
My name is Matthew.
Hey, Matthew.
Yes, and I just want to say that...
got 1 minute.
There's a lot of people that know what's going on over there in Iraq and in Syria, on Pacifica, as a matter of fact, that have firsthand information. And the best I can say is what Bill Maher said on his show a couple of fights ago. What he said was, ISIS is not going to kill you, America. Dow Jones and Monsanto is going to kill you.
All right. What I'm going to do, I got one person who decided they would like 15 seconds of airtime. I thank you very much for calling, Matthew. I'm going to let this person get in about two sentences, and then I'm going to sign off.
Okay.
Take care. Okay, you're on the – hold on. You're on the air. What's your name? What's on your mind? You've got 10 seconds.
This is Mike. If I had to referee this, I would give Egberto a knockout here.
A knockout? Okay.
I'm sorry, Mike.
All right. Well,
he's on the right track.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Got to go. I wish you guys had called earlier. We could have had a great conversation. Thank you so much for calling. Gotta run. Remember, slower traffic, keep right. It's not just a good idea, it's the law. I'll speak to you next week. Save all your questions. Call me then. Good night.
On October 21st, FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai will lead a forum on internet regulation in College Station, Texas. The forum will be hosted by Texas A&M University's Bush School of Government and Public Service and will focus on the FCC's open internet proceedings. The field hearing will begin at 10 a.m. at the Hagler Auditorium of the Annenberg Conference Center, which is adjacent to the Bush School of Government and Public Service. This forum is expected to be the only FCC event in Texas to examine net neutrality before the future of the internet is decided. The public is invited to attend and to make comments. You're listening to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio 90.1 on the FM dial, 89.5 in Galveston, kpft.org worldwide. Find us at KPFT on Twitter and on Facebook as KPFT Houston.
Do you or someone you know own a local dining establishment? KPFT has a pledge drive coming up. And each drive, restaurants in the area feed our phone volunteers who give of their time to help KPFT reach its goals. Donations of food by these establishments are tax deductible and help community radio in the process. We also thank your establishment on air. Call 713-526-4000 for more information on how